everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today's theme is misinformation concerning COVID. I'm very concerned, as many of you are, do we really have the best approach to dealing with this pandemic? For example, have the lockdowns around the world actually decreased infectivity and mortality from the COVID virus? Is the PCR test accurate? Should it be used as a diagnostic tool? It is. Well, I happen to have had one of the only filmed interviews of Dr. Kerry Mullis, who won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry for discovering the PCR. I did a two-hour interview at his California home in 1996. We'll be playing the full interview, posting it in about 2 weeks. My editor's on vacation. When the editor returns, we'll get that right up for you. And you'll see him. He was in complete disdain to the current head of all things on COVID, Anthony Fauci. In fact, he challenged Anthony Fauci to come on a stage, University of South Carolina, and debate him on this. Fauci wouldn't do it. When you consider all the missteps Fauci made when it comes to the war on AIDS, which the mainstream media refuses to do a single item on, where he did not back the drug Bactrim, which could have helped people with PCP pneumonia, could have saved lives because it was known to knock out that pneumonia, but he didn't. As a result, it's estimated over 75,000, mainly young gay men, died from what was the first or second primary cause of AIDS at that time. But also, he promoted and completely supported the use of AZT, the most toxic drug ever allowed outside of thalidomide, into the American medical system. But unlike thalidomide, this was given to millions of individuals, AZT. In fact, it was so toxic that it was banned by the National Cancer Institute, and the scientist who actually invented it said, this is too toxic for anyone. Could you imagine a drug being so toxic they wouldn't even use an experimental drug on terminal cancer patients? But suddenly people were supposed to take this the rest of their life. So Kerry Mullis addresses all these issues. So on an upcoming program devoted to his memory, he died last year, we will play that. But just so you know, Kerry Mullis was very clear and unequivocal. Don't use the PCR for making your diagnosis or viral load or what kind of virus you're actually looking at, because it's not going to tell you that. So as a result, we're using exactly that wrong example. If you test positive on PCR, yeah, then you're a case. If you're a case, then you should get vaccinated. So there's a whole lot going on that's a problem. So today we're going to play two tapes. The first tape is with, both tapes are with Dr. Sam Bailey. She is a board-certified physician in New Zealand. She has a very tenacious way of going about looking for the truth. And by the way, she's not afraid to put up on her screen so you can see it, all of the charts that are official government charts, and then deconstruct them, showing you the incorrectness or the errors filling all these charts in scientific studies. She's a very intelligent person. She has no political or economic agenda. She's just laying down the facts. So she's going to be interviewing one of the world's leading virus experts, Dr. Klaus Kohling, K-O-H-N-L-E-I-N. By the way, I knew him, I believe I even interviewed him back in the 1980s concerning his views on the HIV virus. In any case, he is not afraid to come forward and, using examples of what was done wrong with the war on AIDS, he will discuss what we're doing wrong with the war on COVID. And then the separate discussion is about the truth about the PCR test. This is a shorter comments from her only, but she takes all the information on the PCR test and she deconstructs them. And she shows what's wrong with how we're going about this. So just about everything you could do wrong, we're doing wrong. In fact, I don't know anything we're doing right. Yes, the virus is real. Yes, it kills people. But so does keeping people at home. So does taking a person from a nursing home into a hospital who has COVID, then sending that person back into the nursing home where they kill everyone else in the nursing home. Thousands upon thousands have died because of that. Governor of New York and other people have been responsible. No one's taken responsibility for everyone dying prematurely. So this is our program. It's a real eye-opener. So please pay attention to it, because it's more information to allow you to have a more objective and honest perspective. Now to our program.
I'm truly thrilled to be able to talk to you today, Klaus, and I suspect this is going to be a really interesting introduction for the people at home who are keen to learn more about the COVID-19 pandemic. Could you tell me a little bit about your background and how you came about to writing your book, Virus Mania?
Yeah, well, I'm a very orthodox internal medical doctor. I did my internship in the university in Kiel in the oncologic department. And since 1993, I'm in my own practice here, and I'm treating a lot of people who are critical of antiviral treatment, especially AIDS patients, HIV positive patients, who are trying to avoid antiviral treatment. And AIDS was actually the main problem which made me writing this book. So it's already 20 years old. So with Thorsten Engelbrecht, I wrote this book 20 years ago, when the first AIDS patients, or 2 years later, when the AIDS epidemic appeared in the US, and a few years later, we had the first AIDS patients here. And I was at the oncologic department at the university at that time, and I came across with my first AIDS patient who was suffering from a lymphoma. And I asked, and all of a sudden it was told, he has AIDS now. And I asked, how comes he has AIDS now? Yesterday he was suffering from a lymphoma. Then they told me, well, he's got a positive HIV test. And then I stopped a while and said, well, okay, but that's not a new epidemic. It might be an epidemic of a new test, because it was not a new clinical disease, this lymphoma. And years later, I recognized that the whole thing was a test pandemic. It went around the world like COVID-19 today via testing. There were no new clinical diseases. It started with pneumonia in previously healthy young men. That was actually the first paper who was published about the first AIDS cases. It was four previously healthy young men who died in pneumonias in their 30s. So they were not very old. What was not written in that paper was that they were hopelessly drug abusing homosexuals, who especially used one drug, which was amyl nitrite, which was very upcoming in that time after the gay liberation. You can see it in the sale numbers of amyl nitrite. It exploded at that time. And these drugs are very toxic. They are immunologically toxic and they are cancerogenic. And that was the real cause of the AIDS epidemic. In the early days, it was seen as a lifestyle problem. It first was called GRID, for gay-related immune deficiency, which it is still today. But via the HIV test, it spread all over the world. And because the HIV test cross-reacts with tuberculosis antigens, for instance, and lipoarabinomannan, which is a content of the cell wall of fungi also, there's quite a good correlation between tuberculosis, and fungal diseases. That's why the distribution of HIV was high in Africa. And after the introduction of the test in Africa, the president of South Africa was told his land is in the grip of a very hard AIDS epidemic, and he didn't notice anything. So he did one thing, which was very clever. He asked his undertakers, how is the situation? Is it booming? Have you a lot of money? And they turned on. They said, there's nothing. We have not more funerals. And the same situation we have now here in COVID. We have no excess mortality in Germany, nothing. I asked our undertakers here in Kiel. They said the first quartal of this year was a catastrophe.
Now, I'd like to ask you about the claims of excess mortality from COVID-19 coronavirus. The US, the UK, Brazil, Italy, Spain, France, Belgium, and the Netherlands, for example, have been affected by significant excess mortalities. In the USA and Europe alone, an additional 200,000 people died in the first half of 2020 compared to the same period the year before. Doesn't this show that COVID-19 is a potentially deadly virus?
Yeah, well, after the first quartal of this year, which ended in March, I may show you this curve, which is from Euromomo. Can you see that?
Yes.
Yeah. There you see the yearly excess mortality of the normal flu.
Yes.
In the years 2017, 2018, 2019, and then you see 2020, and then you see how the normal flu just wanted to disappear in the end of March, and all of a sudden there is this sharp increase in the middle of April.
Yes.
That's a time when the usual flu is gone, and on accident, a friend of mine showed me some data from the WHO studies, and I saw how they started it in the end of March, starting April. And I looked at the data and I saw that they started it with hydroxychloroquine in a very high dose, 2.4 gram on the first day, followed with 800 milligrams for 10 days. So people had in their blood, after 10 days, they had almost 10 grams of hydroxychloroquine.
What would be a normal dose for hydroxychloroquine for people that don't know?
Yeah, hydroxychloroquine is an old treatment. We know it for years, and you use it for prophylaxis for malaria. It's quite untoxic. I used it when I went to Singapore or the Sri Lanka many years ago. We also have experience in rheumatoid patients. They also take it for years in a dosage 400 milligrams, 200 until 400 milligrams. That's relative untoxic, so you can take it for years. But this treatment, this hydroxychloroquine, has a very short therapeutic range. That means you can overdose it very easily. Mm-hmm. That happened in April, and this sharp increase is the only explanation is this overdosage of hydroxychloroquine, because we heard it also in Brazil and in England. People were dying like flies in April. I heard it from a friend of mine who takes care of the intensive station here in Kiel. They were telephoning with the colleagues in London, and they got the message, well, they are dying here, it's terrible. And they were really anxious here in Kiel as well, that this wave will come to us also, but nothing happened, because we in Germany, we didn't use this high dosage.
With regards to potential COVID-19 treatments, there have been several large studies this year, in particular the Solidarity, Discovery, Recovery and REMAP trials. What is your analysis of these trials?
In England, in London, they used the Recovery study, was a special English program. they use this high dosage of hydroxychloroquine. And of course, doctors noticed it after a while. And then the studies were stopped. The studies were all stopped in all over the world. In Brazil, they stopped the study because of very bad heart complications. That's what I have to say. This hydroxychloroquine, if you use it in this high dosage, it does heart arrhythmias. And it does lethal heart arrhythmias. Right? That's why it is used if you want to kill yourself.
Yes, for euthanasia.
Yeah, also. And the question is, how could it happen? How could it happen that they take this high dosage? And the leader of this study, Professor Landry, was asked, how could it come that you take this high dosage? And he said, well, COVID-19 is a new disease and we have to start with something. So that was his answer. And another colleague asked him, well, but okay, it's a reasonable answer, but why this high dosage? Then he said, well, he looked how they had treated amoebiasis in the early days, and it was a similar, they took a similar amount of pills. And then the other doctor said, well, I never treated amoebiasis with hydroxychloroquine. We used hydroxyquinoline. I think he confused it. This man is a dangerous man.
Yeah.
And that's the only explanation I have for this high dosage regime. It is immediately toxic and you get these lethal heart arrhythmias. It was Boris Johnson, the
minister of
he was in that therapeutic window, and all of a sudden he has to go to intensive care because his arrhythmias were dangerous. But he survived. Not everybody dies from it, but very susceptible, even very old people have the bigger chance of dying from it. But since these studies are stopped, there is there's no excess mortality in no country anymore.
What is your analysis of those trials, if you can summarize, I guess?
Well, these trials, the Solidarity Discovery and REMAP study, the REMAP was done in Belgium, and that is a very interesting point, because Belgium is the direct neighbor to Germany, and I can show you this. We have this sharp increase in Belgium.
In the middle one, yeah.
In the middle of April.
That's quite big.
And we don't have it in Germany, so this virus obviously stops at the border.
Very convenient.
The killer virus stops at the border. There's no other explanation. It's the treatment which caused this damage.
Recently, I read a case report from The Lancet that was published earlier this year describing a 50-year-old man who had fever, chills, coughing, tiredness, and shortness of breath and was diagnosed as having COVID-19. He was then treated with some antiviral drugs, specifically interferon alpha-2b, lopinavir, and ritonavir, an antibiotic, moxifloxacin, and cortisone. Despite all of these treatments, he died 14 days later. This case seems to illustrate how deadly COVID-19 can be, but what do you think?
I found this case report in The Lancet. And the problem is, when a case report is published in The Lancet, that means that every doctor thinks, well, we can start with such a treatment, because this study was not published in The Lancet to show how damaging this treatment is, but they wanted to show how dangerous is COVID-19, that in spite of this all treatments, the patient died. But you can easily, as a doctor, you know, that cortisone in this high doses, they gave him up to 500 milligram cortisone per day. 500, usually treat 50 milligram, not 500. That stops your immune system completely. So this patient had no chance. You stop the immune system and the virus can do whatever it wants. So this is a therapy. It's driven by fear, because the doctor, like the politician, if you treat too much, you only have a problem as a doctor if you treat not enough. If you do nothing, then the patient gets worse or dies, then you have a real problem. If you do everything, like in that case, and the patient dies, you have done whatever you can, but unfortunately the patient died. But this is the problem in our time, the big danger of overtreatment. The danger of overtreatment is everywhere at the moment, because the pharma industry wants to sell diseases, of course. They cannot earn money with diseases which are self-limiting, like COVID-19 is a self-limiting disease. It comes and goes like the flu. It has not more potential, not more killing potential than the normal yearly flu. That's what the data say now, and even the WHO published it. Look at the last papers from John Ioannidis from the Stanford University. They exactly show that the COVID-19 virus has no more killing potential than the normal flu, and that's why the things we do are ridiculous at the moment. The mask and the lockdowns, they are damaging the whole population. They make the people depressive, and the suicide rate is climbing up at the moment. It's unbelievable. I think it's a political thing, and it's not a health problem.
Klaus, I know quite a few of my viewers are interested in hydroxychloroquine and have done their own research on this. There is a Yale epidemiologist, Harvey Riche, who has said that the relevant studies with COVID-19 patients all show significant benefit for high-risk outpatients when hydroxychloroquine is used in combination with an antibiotic and or zinc in lower doses. As an expert in this area, what are your thoughts about these treatments?
The problem is, as I said already, that COVID-19 is a self-limiting disease. So you can give whatever you want. If you don't kill the patient with it, he will recover. So he will recover also with 400 milligram hydroxychloroquine combined with zinc and azithromycin. Well, I would treat a patient if he is getting a pneumonia. It's usually a bacterial superinfection. Then azithromycin is a very good treatment. I would do that also if there is a pneumonia. But there are doctors who give it prophylactically and things like that, yeah. And also this studies, I would love to see studies who are placebo controlled. And we are lacking that. These are studies who show, these are observational studies who show that people recover after this treatment. Well, my patients, I had also some patients who had COVID-19. I did nothing of that all. We just let them stay at home until you are healthy again, like the common cold, yeah. And that works as well. I don't see any sense for hydroxychloroquine, because it's still immunosuppressive. We use it in autoimmune diseases. And a professor there in France, Roald Didier, he experimented with hydroxychloroquine and he did in vitro investigation with it and found out that it has an antiviral effect. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, I don't need placebo-controlled studies. If I see an in vitro effect, then we can start with it just like that. But if a self-limiting disease is there, like a flu, you have to need a placebo control. And if there is a good placebo control with and hydroxychloroquine combined with zinc and azithromycin is better than placebo, okay, then I would say, let's take it. But in the absence of good placebo controls, it's just useless.
Do you see any parallels between the overtreatment for COVID-19 patients and the treatment of patients suffering from other potentially infectious or contagious diseases?
I'm coming from the AIDS problem. I would mention that again, because most doctors who are at my age, I'm 65 now, vividly remember the time when we treated people with 1500 milligram of ACT, which was the first drug which was approved treating HIV. And this was announced in the New England Journal of Medicine and in a placebo-controlled trial, which was stopped too early to see the detrimental effect of ACT. But the fear was very great at that time. After this first licensing study, it looked like the Verum group would have a little bit advantage compared to the placebo group. But when you looked at the side effects, you saw that the Verum group only survived because they got life-saving blood transfusion. So it was to see in that group already that the bone marrow got a very bad damage.
Yeah.
It was AIDS prescription at that time, the critics called it. But we stopped that treatment 4 years later when the Concord study came. And the Concord study showed the more ACT you take, the more deadly is the disease. All the people who died on AIDS, most of them died 1991. That was 4 years after introduction of ACT. There was a big peak, similar to now to COVID-19, but it was over 4 years. And then we stopped ACT and we got other drugs which had not that side effects. You can ask, how could that happen? The ACT overtreatment. The danger of overtreatment is everywhere. That's why we need these placebo-controlled studies. I hope that the treatments against COVID-19 stops now because of all these bad experiences. And if you look at the mechanism of remdesivir, it's the same thing like ACT. It has no use whatever in a acute viral infection because it is also immunosuppressive. Mm. But with remdesivir, if you take 6 pills of remdesivir, you don't die from it. They sell one package for $2,000.
€2,000. Really? Yeah. Klaus, a lot of these medications that have been prescribed for COVID-19 seem to be immunosuppressant.
It's the narrative, what they always say, if COVID-19 makes an interleukin storm. But the interleukin storm is nothing more than the defense of the body against viruses. And if you stop that, then you stop the immune response of the host.
Yes.
That makes it easier for the virus to do damage. So it's the wrong way. And it's always, you can say it for everyone, it's always a wrong way to fight against viruses. We have to live with them. That's the story behind our book. You have to live together with viruses and you cannot fight against them. It's useless. It's damaging the host. That's all what you get. The WHO study now shows a big disappointment is the bad results of remdesivir.
Given what we know so far, what treatments, if any, do you think should be used for suspected COVID-19?
As I said, there is no treatment against COVID-19 at the moment. And that's what the German paper of doctors said, the Deutsches Ärzteblatt. And I wrote a letter to him and asked him, when there is no treatment against COVID-19, there are many, many treatments which are obviously used uncontrolled. All these treatments are uncontrolled. Or if they are controlled, after a while you see that it was not good, that they are negative, the studies. That means they did damage. That's a problem. Treating COVID-19 is to rest, and like you do it in the flu. You shouldn't treat the flu. The Tamiflu, which they try to mark every year again, it doesn't work. It never worked. And that's the message. You cannot fight against viruses. You have to relax and you recover because you have an immune system and that works. And this was the big lie which Fauci spread in the world. Fauci is a very well-known immunologist. He's responsible for the ACT disaster in the beginning 90s. And he is now again there and says, this virus is such a terrible foe. Humanity has no immune system against it. And it's completely nonsense. We have a very good immune system. We are not dying from infectious diseases at the moment. We have other problems. We're dying of cancer and heart diseases, but not on infectious diseases.
Yeah.
And also this virus is not a big problem for us. It's just a virus, a coronavirus, like we have it every year, but we don't measure it every year. And now the problem is that the world is testing against COVID-19. Mm-hmm. If you would stop the test, you would see nothing anymore. The epidemic would be gone, and nobody would see that there is any problem. But that's what they obviously don't want. Governments, they have to show that there is still something, but otherwise they would have to admit that they had a massive overreaction and all these lockdowns were wrong. And that's what they don't want to admit, of course. And they want to do the vaccine, of course.
I wanted to ask you, Klaus, about this. So what about vaccines? Can they be a solution for coronaviruses?
Probably not, because we looked at the data already, whether you get antibodies after. I had some patients who had antibodies after infection, but 3 months later, there were no antibodies anymore. So you have no lifelong immunity against it. And I wonder how they would do it with a vaccine, or you do it every year again, like the flu. But you want to vaccinate the whole humankind, 7 billion
people.
So it's good business, of course. I believe it is very dangerous, of course, because this is now a fast-track procedure, and in a fast-track procedure, catastrophe is there, of course. Even if you have only 1% problems, that's a lot if you vaccinate the whole world,
Yeah, I agree with you. A question that is close to my heart is in regards to the accuracy of the COVID-19 PCR test. I've made several videos pointing out the shortfalls of the PCR test in some of the COVID medical advisors to the New Zealand government were apparently very unhappy about this. I would love to hear your opinion about the COVID PCR test.
I'm one of those who know Kerry Mullis personally. We had he's the inventor of the PCR test.
Yes.
Kerry Mullis, everybody knows him. He got the Nobel Prize. We had discussions about the PCR test, and he said very clearly, it's not suitable to diagnose disease with it. It's too sensitive, because if there's one piece of RNA or DNA, it might react positive. That does not mean that the patient who is suffering from a pneumonia, that this result is causally linked to the disease. That's the big misassumption people are seeing at the moment. The modern virologists like Christian Drosten work only with PCR, and they have no idea about the clinic. They are no doctors, they are virologists, they have no idea for clinical patients. That's what Drosten admits himself. Well, I'm not a doctor, I have no idea about clinics. I'm a virologist, but these virologists only make the invoice without the host. The host has immune system against the viruses and whatever they measure with their PCR tests. So it's the whole thing is a PCR pandemic, nothing else. 10 years ago, an infectious disease specialist thought she might see pertussis epidemic.
The whooping cough, yes, yeah.
The whooping cough, yeah. Because there was somebody was whooping, and then they thought, well, there might be beginning of the whooping cough epidemic. And then they measured with PCR the whole personnel in the clinic, and they found a lot of positives. They thought, well, that's the beginning of the epidemic, and they tested and tested and tested and tested, and then they gave vaccine and they gave antibiotics. In the end, they tried to find Bordetella pertussis, which is the microbe which actually causes it, and they found it in no patient.
Really?
And then they said, well, this was an epidemic that never was. That was the result of this.
It's amazing.
It was written in the New York Times, but this article, you can find it, the epidemic that never was.
I like your statement of the PCR pandemic. I'm going to copy that.
Yes. really the big problem of our time. You cannot use PCR tests for that.
In your book, Virus Mania, you and your co-author, the journalist Torsten Engelbrecht, raised several fundamental questions about the apparent appearance of SARS coronavirus 1 in 2003. And you pointed out that a gold standard for diagnosis was lacking then. And do you think we have the same problem again with SARS 2?
The inventor, Carlo Urbani, was an Italian doctor who died of the syndrome of SARS 1. I looked at the data of the treatment. He got antiviral treatment with ribavirin at that time, which is a very toxic drug in a high dosage. He got also interferon, he got cortisone, he got everything which is suitable to kill him. And he died, of course, in my view, he died because of the treatment. And that gives the disease a deadly image. That's always the problem. If you over-treat people, and because doctors never think that the people are dying because of their treatment.
Yes.
Despite of treatment, of course.
Yes.
And that gives the microbe the deadly image. That's what we still believe. Every doctor still believes, especially the younger generation who has no idea about the overtreatment with ACT. They still believe HIV is a deadly virus because he's had this deadly image from this overtreatment in the 90s. That's the problem with COVID-19. I say it's a harmless virus. Well, doctor, but there died a lot of people. They always say there died a lot of people. And that's the other thing that the media, the role of the media, bad propaganda to make things dangerous. That's what they're
doing.
They have to show how dangerous the situation is and how careful we have to be.
That what I was meaning to ask you about was more about the gold standard, how there was no gold standard for diagnosis for SARS-1, and there's no gold standard again for SARS-2.
Yeah, there is no gold standard, but it is used as a gold standard, but it's not a gold standard.
Yeah.
You have to find the microbe. If you want to be sure that the disease is caused by a microbe, you have to find the microbe, and you can't use a PCR test for that. To find the virus, then you have to show that this virus do a disease in an animal. So you have to fulfill the Koch'schen Postulate. It's a German doctor who found that the presence of a virus in a host does not mean that it is responsible for a disease. You have to find this virus in a big amount in the tissue, which is sick. So if a patient is dying from a lung, from a pneumonia, you have to find the virus in huge amounts in the lungs. Mm. That's what they didn't do. So they just rely on the PCR test.
It has been an absolute pleasure talking to you, Klaus. I'm so blown away. Thank you for imparting your expertise on this area, because I think we really need this worldwide. It's such an important topic. I'd like to encourage everyone to take a look at the Virus Mania book. And I read this for the first time over the lockdown in March, and I was just absolutely blown away by how well referenced and how detailed, how you were so prescient that this was basically COVID-19 has happened again.
And you happened again, yes.
Yeah.
From the book, how could it happen and can it happen again? That was about the AIDS problem. How could it happen and can it happen again? And it can happen again, obviously. So we have this problem at the moment. Again, a PCR pandemic, which would disappear all of a sudden if you stop this stupid PCR testing.
So what is PCR? PCR stands for polymerase chain reaction. Polymerase means an enzyme that catalyzes the formation of a polymer or long chain molecule from smaller units. In this case, we are talking about DNA, the molecule that carries the vital genetic information for much of the life on our planet. Chain reaction means that the process is carried out multiple times in sequence. This amplification process means a minute sample of DNA is multiplied millions of times to produce sufficient material to allow for genetic and molecular analysis. The history of PCR started in 1976 with the discovery of TAC DNA polymerase. The enzyme was found in Thermus aquaticus, a bacteria discovered living in hot springs in Yellowstone National Park. Because the enzyme could withstand temperatures of 95 degrees centigrade, it was a practical molecule for the thermally dependent PCR process. Prior to this, fresh enzyme would have to be added at every single cycle. Things really took off in the 1980s when Carrie Mullis realized how to put TAC polymerase to use, and the enzyme became commercially promoted. Mullis was awarded the Nobel Prize in Chemistry in 1993 and is generally considered to be the inventor of PCR.
I won't get into all the technical details of PCR, as for our purposes, the principles and application are more important than all the biochemistry. However, for those of you interested, I'll include links with more detail below in the description.
In summary, the process starts with heating the sample of DNA. This separates the double-stranded DNA into two pieces of single-stranded DNA. Primers are then added. These are short pieces of DNA that are designed to flank the target section of DNA for amplification. Usually two primers are used, one to bind to each of the opposite strands of the target DNA section. The polymerase then synthesizes a new DNA strand that is complementary to the target DNA section. It builds this from nucleosides present in the reaction mixture. This essentially completes a cycle, and the amount of target DNA has been doubled. The cycle then starts again, but this time with around twice as much target DNA as the first time. The DNA Learning Center had produced a nice little video outlining the PCR process in 3D, which you can check out in the link if you're interested. The cycle is typically repeated 25 to 40 times, and it is important to realize the exponential amplification of material that occurs with these numbers. For example, at 40 cycles, there would be around 1,000 billion copies produced. However, TAC DNA polymerase has a certain number of mismatch errors, so higher cycle numbers are more likely to produce inaccurate results. It is also important to realize that a typical PCR test only detects a small sequence of genetic material. It does not detect anything close to the entire genome of a purported organism. Okay, so we have a pretty neat way of detecting tiny amounts of DNA, and actually RNA as well. What could possibly go wrong? Well, quite a bit when the technique is used to draw conclusions beyond that for which it was designed. The inventor of PCR himself warned that the PCR test doesn't tell you that you are sick. These tests cannot detect free infectious viruses at all. And as I've discussed in previous videos, the manufacturers of PCR tests usually have disclaimers stating that they are not suitable for diagnostic purposes and that they are non-specific. Let's explore some of the reasons why this is so. Firstly, the very nature of the biological samples is problematic. When a biological specimen, for example a nasal swab, is taken from a living host, it contains all sorts of things, including genetic material from any number of microorganisms. Humans are covered in billions of microorganisms, most of them living in symbiosis with us, meaning they don't cause any harm or any disease. In fact, many of them are essential to our very existence. Experiments with newborn animals have revealed that attempting to raise them in sterile conditions leads to rapid death. Most microorganisms found in and around us have nothing to do with illness, so the mere apparent detection of their presence is not a cause for alarm. Additionally, as Carrie Mullis pointed out, a PCR test does not detect an infectious agent. This is because it is an indirect test that only detects genetic fragments of organisms. Your body may have encountered a potential pathogen that your immune system rapidly destroyed, but the PCR test still detects remaining fragments. It also needs to be established that a genetic sequence is absolutely specific to a certain organism, and this is where diagnostic PCR can fall apart. Due to the almost incomprehensible amount of genetic material on the planet, it is rash to assume total specificity when it comes to particular sequences. What about SARS-CoV-2? Was it even formally isolated prior to the development of a PCR test? As you are aware, we are currently working on the third English edition of Virus Mania, and this has been something we have been looking into. We asked the groups that reported that they had identified the novel virus by electron micrograph whether they had formally purified the virus. The responses were all the same. No. Even Michael Law from the Robert Koch Institute wrote in an email that we received on September 4th, 2020, "I am not aware of a paper which purified isolated SARS-CoV-2. Hence, it cannot be concluded with any confidence that the so-called COVID-19 PCR tests were specifically calibrated to a brand new viral pathogen. The research work of geneticist Barbara McClintock is also worth a mention here. In her Nobel Prize speech from 1983, she reported that the genetic material of living beings can constantly alter by being hit by shocks. These shocks can be toxins, but can also be from other materials that produce stress in the test tube. This in turn can lead to the formation of new genetic sequences, which were unverifiable both in vivo and in vitro previously. So this raises another complicating factor when considering where genetic sequences are actually originating from and how different conditions in life and the lab can change genetic expression. But even if the PCR test was known to be reliably correlated to a particular organism, something more is required. To prove beyond any doubt that the PCR can truly measure if a person is affected by a disease-causing microorganism, we need to do a blinded experiment. And you guessed it, this hasn't happened to date. It cannot be emphasized enough how problematic it is when a test has no connection to actual illness. To put it in perspective, there is little doubt that some tests are very useful and have strong relationships to illness. For example, if we have a patient who reports fatigue and a blood test reveals a hemoglobin of 65 grams per liter, we have a very strong indication that they are anemic and need further investigations and treatment. This is not the case with many PCR tests, where a positive result doesn't tell you anything meaningful about the test subject. And as we saw in 2020, even athletes at the top of their game were testing so-called positive with the COVID PCR tests. To go back to our hemoglobin example, we would not expect Ronaldo to make it through the first 10 minutes of the game if his hemoglobin was 65. So I'm sure the soccer star would have much more confidence in this test. PCR tests may be qualitative or quantitative. Essentially, qualitative PCR is the traditional technique which is used to decide whether a DNA fragment is present or not, whereas quantitative PCR or qPCR is used to determine how much of the DNA fragment is present in the sample. There has been confusion with regards to this, as the product descriptions of the RT-qPCR tests for SARS-CoV-2 state they are qualitative tests, contrary to the fact that the Q in qPCR stands for quantitative. In fact, one of my co-authors, Torsten Engelbrecht, applied pressure to the Charité with regards to the Drosten-Korman PCR test and received the following response. If real-time RT-PCR is involved, to the knowledge of the Charité, in most cases these are limited to qualitative detection. Clear as mud. In any case, as I've previously discussed in this video, for some reason the FDA and other health authorities have failed to collect any significant data on PCR cycle thresholds, despite Dr. Fauci saying it was an important value for the clinician to consider. Check out that video for more about cycle thresholds. With regards to SARS-CoV-2, there is an additional issue in that the target genetic material is for a presumed RNA virus. This means that before starting the actual PCR process, the target RNA must be converted to complementary DNA with the enzyme reverse transcriptase. Professor of Molecular Medicine, Stephen A. Buston, pointed to the problem that in the course of this conversion process, the amount of DNA obtained with the same RNA-based material can vary widely, even by a factor of 10. So this initial step can also cause variation in whether the subsequent PCR test is considered positive or not. Interestingly, Buston, who helped develop the MIQE guidelines to standardize PCR protocols, had the following to say about COVID-19 PCR tests. We demonstrate that elementary protocol errors, inappropriate data analysis, and inadequate reporting continue to be rife, and conclude that the majority of published RT-qPCR data are likely to represent technical noise. In other words, a total mess. So why are PCR tests being promoted as fit for purpose for COVID-19? It's hard to know all the reasons, but there are huge profits to be made and advancements of certain agendas. There is also likely to be many conflicts of interest by those with links to political power and public funds for their work. A viewer sent me an article that was written by a New Zealand scientist called Susie Wiles. She states there was a misinformation video about PCR tests circulating. New Zealand is a small place, so presumably this is one of mine? Unfortunately, she doesn't exactly explain which part is wrong, only that it is chock full of false information. Goodness me, what a highly scientific rebuttal. Firstly, it seems that the spin-off website has received $222,000 in funds from Creative New Zealand, which is a division of the New Zealand government. So perhaps the nature of the article is not that surprising. Anyway, let's have a look at where Susie goes astray and how she has cut more than a few corners with her claims. The PCR test looks for specific genetic sequences that are only found in the SARS-CoV-2 virus. As we've discussed, this is a dubious claim, as the virus was never fully isolated and purified prior to the development of the PCR test. It also suggests that we have sequenced the genomes of all significant organisms on the planet and know about every change in genetic expression, as per Barbara McClintock's work. The manufacturers of the PCR test certainly don't share Susie's enthusiasm, and in fact include disclaimers like, "This product is for research use only and is not intended for diagnostic use, and may react to other organisms." That makes it very suitable as a screening tool, as it has such a low false positive rate. People are highly unlikely to test positive unless the virus is present in the sample. I can only view this as confused or disingenuous. Where has it been established that it is a suitable screening tool when it wasn't even established as a suitable diagnostic tool? The Corman-Drosten paper that triggered the worldwide promotion of COVID PCR tests never established how it should be applied in clinical use. And this is one of the many reasons why a consortium of scientists have requested its retraction. It is also unsound medical practice to claim that COVID-19 is diagnosed by a PCR test, and that the definition of COVID-19 is a positive PCR test as a standalone. As I've discussed in previous videos, there can be no estimate of false positive rates, as there is nothing to compare it to. No gold standard. She can only be referring to the false positive rate in the lab setting with control samples, not real-world application in the community. I've talked about the gross limitations of this in my fact-checking video. We know this is true from all the thousands of negative tests we've seen here in New Zealand. This bizarre statement is a complete non sequitur. In no way establishes the suitability of a test. It tells us nothing about the status of the people being tested. There have been no blinded trials to establish the validity of the test for actual illness. Anyway, you can see that she is attempting to build the case for PCR tests, but already the foundations are inadequate. Some of the article is fine and talks about cycle thresholds, but then she gets into hypotheticals and a test, trace, isolate mantra public education campaign. Perhaps to her it seems that mass testing can only be beneficial, but this ignores the huge costs that include A, financial costs. An Official Information Act request in New Zealand, a country of 5 million people, revealed $74 million in PCR swab and lab costs alone over a mere 6-week period. The total cost will be far in excess of this, and be psychological and social costs to people who believe that they are actually ill and isolate because of a positive test result. However, most conspicuous by its absence in the article is where it was established that positive PCR test results have anything to do with illness. She completely misses this crucial point. And this is not surprising because, as I discussed in my video, What is a COVID-19 Case?, it has never been established. As my co-author and seasoned campaigner Klaus Kuhnlein would say, she has been swept up in the PCR pandemic. Unfortunately, scientists like Susie seem to have become detached from the very nature of human health as they focus on molecular test results and top-down political policies. Interestingly, some of the authorities that heavily promoted the COVID PCR tests are now softening their positions, with a European court declaring the tests not fit for purpose and potential lawsuits brewing. Last month, the WHO quietly issued a statement suggesting more caution with so-called positive tests. Could this be the beginning of a gradual backdown from unsound science? Over a decade before PCR tests appeared on the scene, Nobel laureate for medicine, Sir Frank McFarlane Burnett, made a prescient warning.
Thank you all for listening. I'm Gary Knoll. Have a nice day.